This is an appendix to episodes 39 and 40 of Pomegranate Health. As discussed in those podcasts on rebooting CPD, there will be some changes over the next 2 years to the college's MyCPD framework. Strengthened CPD, as it's called, forms the first of the 5 pillars described in the Professional Performance Framework of the Medical Board of Australia. In the following outtakes, you'll hear Richard Doherty, Dean of the RACP, describe the other 4 pillars. These ask for greater scrutiny of aging and isolated doctors, and also those with multiple substantiated complaints against them. There's call for an updated code of conduct, and the PPF also anticipates that health practitioners will outline a professional development plan of their CPD intentions every year. At the end of this clip, you'll hear Auckland cardiologist Tony Scott describe a similar process in New Zealand called regular practice review.
So just as the MCNZ has its recertification and CPD policy, the MBA has come up with the Professional Performance Framework. And this is a very careful document built around the prosaically named 5 pillars. The first pillar is strengthened CPD, which we'll come back to in a minute. The second pillar is titled Active Assurance of Safe Practice. And this refers to screening of practitioners at risk for substandard practice. So which groups might be of concern in this respect?
So at the moment, the medical board has identified 2 key groups here. One is elderly doctors for whom there is already a body of evidence that suggests that performance tails off with age, and the recommendation of the expert advisory group was that people still in practice over 70 years of age should be asked to show that they are indeed still fit to practice. This has very broad support in the community and is largely supported by the literature.
We won't dwell too much on the ageing physician. We did cover this back in episode 22 on transitioning towards retirement, which discusses how to recognise the challenges faced by ageing physicians. There's another clause in the document focusing on professionally isolated clinicians. So how do you define professional isolation?
Well, I think that's yet to be fully worked through. But as you can imagine, there are people who work in remote locations who, through their use of information technology and their interactions with peers, are in no way professionally isolated. And there are people who work in metropolitan areas who, because of their own nature and the fact that they work in an independent practice and so on, might be very isolated. So that's still a work in progress, still very much something to be clarified. But it's certainly professional isolation rather than geographic isolation. The other group that has been identified is people who have multiple substantiated complaints against them, where those complaints relate to behaviour. Mm-hmm. There are some people who have multiple complaints which aren't substantiated, and of course that wouldn't count. And there are sometimes complaints about things that really are outside the scope of what would be considered relevant to this.
You've already mentioned this, that the third pillar of the 5 is strengthened assessment and management of medical practitioners with multiple substantiated complaints. It says that CPD providers will have a strengthened role in supporting remediation of medical practitioners with identified performance gaps. And this might include sharing information with employers and other health sector agencies about medical practitioners who pose an identified risk to patients.
This is a really big issue for the college that we will have to think very carefully about. But it touches on a really, really important point about the role of the college. One of the things that we've been particularly concerned about in the couple of years that this has been evolving has been the idea that colleges might somehow be assigned a regulatory role. And while that doesn't appear to be the case, I think we all have to be very careful about that and make sure that whilst the college is absolutely prepared to articulate and endorse standards, what is appropriate behaviour, what is appropriate learning, what are appropriate skills, we are not the regulator and we don't wish to take that role on. The process of remediation and I guess revalidating or, you know, assessing and assuring that someone's practice is at an appropriate standard is really quite challenging. It takes a while. It requires wise supervision and input, and We've got a lot of thinking to do about how that would actually work at a practical level. We're fortunate in that we do it from time to time with people who've been out of practice, mostly because of illness. In that situation, these are people who are keen to return to practice. It's usually quite straightforward to find mentors and supervisors who can assist them in that. And it's been a very rewarding process that we've undertaken on a number of occasions in the last few years.
The fourth pillar of the professional practice framework refers to a revised code of conduct. And the fifth pillar is titled Collaborations to Foster a Positive Culture. Acting honestly, treating others with dignity, not behaving offensively in the workplace, no unlawful discrimination, everything about self-care and supporting colleagues. I don't think there's anything too controversial here, unless you want to add anything, Richard. I'll just use it as an excuse to plug episode 30 about physician well-being and burnout. And in episode 16, we talked about gender equity in the profession. So these are all issues that are wrapped up in it.
And I think it's fair to say that burnout and gender equity would be two issues that would be right up the top of things considered in those two pillars.
Another component of strengthened CPD that becomes obligatory in 2021 will be the requirement to draw up a professional development plan. And until that date, it will be a recommendation. In New Zealand too, this is currently a recommendation only, but likely to become mandated. For those who've never had the joy of plotting out a professional development plan, can you describe what it involves?
The idea is basically that you give some thought at the beginning of a CPD cycle to what you're going to do during that time, that it's based on your assessment of your needs on reflection from your previous cycle of CPD activity, and that you plot out some activities and take active steps to actually achieve that. Now, there are a range of possible templates that could be used. It may be that some people will prefer to have a nice, simple, broad perspective template, and that other people will prefer to have one which has got lots of granularity. There is some evidence in the literature to suggest that people who go to the trouble of filling out a really granular development plan have a higher probability of completing it. But whether that's actually the value of a development plan or not is not entirely clear.
And some fellows already participate in these things in their workplace. And New Zealand fellows do have an annual practice review which maps the individual's plans and support that they receive within the organisation. This can be paired with reflections about job size and staffing. So what has the college learned from the New Zealand experience of these?
Well, I think I'd probably say, in recognition of Tony Scott's activities in Waitemata, that one of the things we've tried to do in a number of meetings is to try and find ways to actually get the most possible synergies so that people can use data for both CPD reporting as well as for performance management requirements within their employment, if that's relevant as well. Recognising, of course, that in Australia as well, technically, anyone who's employed in the public health system has an obligation to undertake a performance management process.
In New Zealand, you've had the regular practice review format for the last few years. How is regular practice review structured exactly?
Now, what the college aimed to do was to develop a process that fulfilled the requirements of credentialing exercises and annual appraisals or annual reviews, and was also oriented towards the professional development and maintenance of standards. So we agreed on a two-tiered process where you had a service, what is now called, referred to as a service development survey, that looked at the actual environment in which the physician worked, and a professional development review which was focused on the individual.
Yeah.
So the PDR, which is the individual, is something that happens annually, and it is an hour to an hour and a half long interview, which is not aiming to actually conduct a direct review of any particular aspect of the individual's practice, but rather to look at their overall framework in terms of what they do. And it's designed to look at, for example, what peer review activity they undertake, but also to actually actively look at their professional development plans, what they're planning to do, where they're at in their career, what their medium long-term goals are, for example, and how they're actually putting those into place. And that this can be very basic. And within our own department over the last 4 or 5 years, this has been very focused on the actual job structure at a very basic level of job size, trying to match the service demands with the individual's ability to provide that. At a very base level, looking at the numbers of staff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's critically important to someone's professional development. If they're spending a lot of time with service commitments and not able to focus on anything else, then that's going to be detrimental in the longer term. So the PDR framework, coupled with the service development review as well, allows for that structuring.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling was that this would be much more valuable than actually just stepping in on a clinician's practicing life for one day and looking at what they did, which is what is done with some other areas. Now, there is value in that to an extent, but it's very much just a snapshot. And in some of the colleges, for example, are much more detailed than that. They'll actually go and spend 2 or 3 days with a clinician.
Right. So what you've described is a sort of professional development meeting. Is that different from the practice review where you need to include some sort of multi-source feedback and, you know, audit and logbooks and this kind of thing?
It is, in the sense that you're not actually doing the review while you're having the meeting. But it's what it basically emphasizes is that the other things, the other peer review activities and the other quality improvement activities need to be there.
You present those at such a meeting.
You present them at the meeting and you go over them. You know, like, for example, I'll have a meeting with a colleague and we'll go over the fact that they've done a multi-source feedback. And while I'm not going to be looking at the output of that or what was said or anything like that, I will be talking to the individual about their response to it. You know, firstly, they've done it, so that's checked.
Mm-hmm.
But also, how did they find it? What did they take out of it? How are they going to respond to it? Et cetera, et cetera. And similarly, it would be looking at, you know, what are they doing with regard to their technical skills, maintaining those? You know, how are they peer reviewing themselves, if you like? So I'd be talking about, in the case of the interventionists, their inbuilt structure, what they're doing and how that's going. Is it still going?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did it start off with a hiss and a roar and then stop, or et cetera?
Last question I have for you is, there was also concern as to the confidentiality of the final reports. Some participants were worried that if this was going to be seen by peers or management, it might affect their professional relationships. How has it been managed in the New Zealand setting?
I think this is something that we talked a lot about right back at the beginning of the process, and the strong feeling of the CPD committee in New Zealand, and I think also reflected in Australia, was that this data belonged to the fellow. And we actually extended that to a large chunk of the PDR process as well, and that the information belonged to the fellow. If it was required or if it was sought for other purposes, then that had to be with the fellow's explicit permission and through the fellow. So with regard to the medical council, for example, our feeling, and I don't know how this has changed over the last 2 or 3 years, but I suspect it hasn't. Our feeling was that the multi-source feedback, the PDR, et cetera, was conducted. It belonged to the fellow. If the medical council wanted to get some information from that, then they did it by approaching the fellow, as they do now with our other CPD activities. It was not something that was kept by the college, certainly not kept by the college, and to a large extent it was not something that was automatically kept in its entirety by the employer either. I mean, there would be some components that would be. I don't see the multi-source feedback as being one of those that could be accessed by the employer as part of the credentialing framework, or the credentialing component, if you like, of the process. It's a very valid concern, though, and I think it's something that we have to address up front, because that will stop the process if people are worried about that.